revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we have a return guest, someone who I love speaking with because it's an education for me about our economic system. And I think this is a very timely interview because we're in the throes of this government shutdown. And I know that there's a milestone in terms of a date, November 1st, where some of the SNAP benefits are going to be, I think, taken away. And we're going to speak about entitlement spending because that's really where we are. And I don't think a lot of people know a lot about it. I certainly learned a lot reading his article. So I wanted to thank Dr. Daniel Sutter for joining me today. As you know, he is a Charles G. Koch Professor of Economics with the Manuel H. Johnson Center for Political Economy at Troy University. And he wrote an amazing article, which you can find on yellowhammer.com. And Dr. Sutter, one, I want to thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be on your show, Dr. George, and happy to come on and talk about this.
Thank you. So let's start off with, what is an entitlement? Because when I think of people saying that healthcare is a right and Medicare and Social Security are things that people are guaranteed, that's not exactly right, is it?
Correct, yes. So that's an important point. So we use the term entitlement as if it's somehow a right, but then we also use this term entitlement with regard to federal spending. For federal spending, traditionally, Congress would have to appropriate the funds for the funds to be able to be spent. As we see right now with the government shutdown, since Congress hasn't appropriated funds, then the government doesn't have any money that they're legally allowed to spend. So in the normal appropriations process, Congress has to appropriate the money, and then the agencies or different programs can spend the money that's been appropriated. It's different for the programs that we call entitlement programs with respect to federal budgeting. These would be programs that anybody, all of these programs have statutory legal requirements that allow somebody to qualify for the benefits. So Social Security, Medicare, unemployment insurance, and anybody who qualifies for the criteria and then enrolls and gets approved and into the program, then these programs will spend as much money as is necessary to meet all of the legally obligated spending for however many people sign up without Congress first appropriating the money. So in effect, they're sort of completely true because Congress can change the eligibility criteria. But once those criteria are set, and as long as they remain in place, if you or I or anybody goes in and shows that we meet the criteria, then we can get these payments, and those payments occur automatically, regardless of whether Congress explicitly appropriates the money. So there's no right in the United States to any kind of welfare or public assistance. There's no right to Social Security or Medicare. These can all be changed. Eligibility can all be changed by the program. So the entitlement is just refers to this sort of element of accounting, as opposed to saying somebody has a legal or constitutional right to something.
Now that makes me think about Social Security specific or Medicare, where they make you pay into these. If you're not actually entitled, for lack of a better way to put it, to get your money at the end of your term, so to speak, then how do they justify taking it from you and making you pay into it? That's kind of strange, isn't it?
Could you repeat that last question?
Sure, I can. Social Security and Medicare are kind of interesting because you have to pay into them when you're on a payroll. You're paying your taxes from your payroll. But if you're not guaranteed, they're just, you know, they can not give you what you've paid into down the road. It doesn't seem quite right somehow.
Well, correct. That's another important point that, because as we look at Social Security, it's not like a retirement a 401k retirement program. It's not like your own personal retirement savings. We pay in with our taxes while we're working, and then there's a benefit schedule. And, of course, the benefits, the amount of benefits you can get does depend on the amount that you pay into the system. But the thing that's different is that that benefit schedule can be changed. And that can be changed. And if that's changed, then it reduces the amount that you're going to get paid out. Mm-hmm. So you're not guaranteed. It's not the Social Security payments that are promised to you are not guaranteed. That money is not yours. And they can also be increased. Congress just there's approved a 2.8%, I believe, cost of living adjustment to the Social Security payment. So all the payments will go up by 2.8% to offset inflation. Again, that's extra money that's coming in that you will get paid out. So they've sort of like just tweaked the benefit formula to adjust for inflation. So we have that formula. Congress can adjust that formula, and so you aren't guaranteed to receive the money.
Now, another thing that, especially Social Security again, because everybody's who's working is going to have to get hit with this at some point. But if you're already paying in, can't they tax you again when you receive your Social Security check? So it's like, is that a double tax?
Yes, that's another good point. That you've paid, in fact, when you earn money, you pay the Social Security payroll taxes. And then when that gets paid out, that gets counted as part of your taxable income. Now, that was, I think, President Trump managed to get an exemption for Social Security benefits through, or at least a partial exemption, for it in his One Big Beautiful Bill that passed here. So some Social Security benefits that I believe now are going to be exempted from taxation. But you're right, there is a form of sort of like double taxation. You get, you're paying the tax to pay for the support of the system, and then that still counts as income tax when you or taxable income when you draw Social Security.
Such a complicated system, and it doesn't seem like the average person benefits from it in the scheme of things. You know, another thing that strikes me too is the Affordable Care Act. You know, if these entitlements are kind of driven by the Treasury Department, right, not by Congress necessarily, how were they able, and I don't know if you can answer this question, but I recall when they were creating the Affordable Care Act that they were taking money from Medicare to fund it, to give people subsidies, and it just didn't make a lot of sense to me. How would that have been allowed in the scheme of things once it's divvied up to Medicare, Medicaid? Well, I guess that's a state thing as well, or Social Security. Isn't that a pot that can't be touched?
Well, I'm not sure exactly where they got the money from, but the idea was to give people some, require people to buy some insurance to avoid against the problem of somebody not having insurance and then being able to get assistance, being able to get treatment at a hospital or emergency room without having any thing to care for it. And then the requirement to have insurance was sort of made a little easier for folks by having the government provide some subsidies for lower income people that their grounds that they weren't going to be able to really afford actual health care, paid for it entirely out of pocket. But if a good portion of that what got subsidized by the government, then they could, they pay at least a little bit toward it, and then the government could pick up a big part of the cost of that for the folks who wouldn't have insurance, wouldn't be eligible for Medicaid, don't have insurance through their health insurance through their job. It's just an alternative way, or maybe like the self-employed, an alternative way for them to be able to purchase health insurance.
As a physician, I have to say that people don't really understand the reality that having health insurance is not actually the same thing as having health care. Because I've seen people have these coverage plans and their out-of-pocket was outrageous. and they'd have to pay that before the first dollar was kicked in from the insurance company. So it was really kind of a shell game, a bait and switch, and insurance companies generally do that. And this made people feel good that they had a card in their pocket. But when it came down to actually using it, that was a whole nother ball game, as I'm sure a lot of people with insurance plans have realized, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's right. Because, I mean, just because you have insurance doesn't mean it's insurance is going to pay very much for the doctor, so it can be difficult to get the doctors to cover, to actually accept such patients. That's a problem with Medicaid in a number of states. Mm-hmm. The Medicaid reimbursements for so many things are so low that doctors try very hard. Like they either won't or try not to accept new Medicaid patients because the reimbursement isn't really adequate. And so, yeah, you can have some kind of insurance. But then again, the question of how much of your expenses they actually pay, or if it's very good insurance, that's a separate question. And politicians oftentimes like to try to say they're going to provide us insurance, but then they can do some things in terms of making the insurance not so good. You raise that deductible, you limit what gets covered, mm-hmm. or require these co-pays, and you don't get as much covered as you might possibly think you were. And then if your overall reimbursement isn't that good, you have a hard time finding a doctor willing to accept you. And so you're right. It is a bit of a shell game.
Now, I know it's kind of a little segue, but I just wanted people to understand, too, that in the age of artificial intelligence, it's gotten even more aggressive because we have the insurance companies putting in AI systems and then no doctor got paid for. It happened to me and other practitioners where nothing got paid out for literally months because it didn't work. But then it worked for the insurance company because I'm sure they had the money in their bank getting interest on it while nobody was getting paid. The whole system just needs to be completely overhauled. And from the entitlement standpoint, the big three, are we in a deficit? I mean, we're from an economic standpoint, how low can you go with this? And how long do you think this can last?
That's a good question. I mean, we don't know for sure because borrowing, all borrowing is voluntary in the market. You need to have somebody willing to lend. And I mean, to date, Uncle Sam has found plenty of folks willing to buy our treasury bonds when they issue new treasury bonds because, you know, we just run up another $2 trillion of debt in a year because that's the deficit we're running. And so to date, we've not run into any issues of, being able to sell that debt, being able to find somebody who would want to come in and buy those treasury bonds. Nobody really knows. At some point, people aren't going to want to buy more of it willingly. And where exactly that is, I don't know, but I do certainly know that if we're running a $2 trillion deficit every year, we're going to run up that. We're going to use up our remaining credit relatively quickly. I would think certainly a lot closer to like maybe 10 years than 30 or 40 years.
I'm going to take a break, but I want to know from your standpoint if that ever happens, where do we stand? So let's take our first break on that little cliffhanger and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Daniel Sutter. And before the break, I wanted to leave a little bit of a cliffhanger because you're painting a picture where there's a point of no return where your pockets are so empty and there's so many things hanging on the balance. I'm just going to put it out there. What happens if we reach that point where nobody buys our credit, we're stuck holding the bag? It's like musical chairs where you're the only one, you're left standing. Can our government survive? What happens to us?
Well, that's an excellent question. So what would likely happen is fewer and fewer people are willing to take on additional treasury debt. Then what would likely happen first is we would see the interest rate that the federal government has to be paying to get investors to take up treasury bonds would start to rise. And when that starts rising, that'd be our sign of People are no longer currently and forever. The federal government has been viewed as basically a risk-free investment. If you want to put your money someplace, and you want to have like no danger of losing your investment, and then giving at least some interest in return. That's always been the treasury bonds. That's always been U.S. government debt. There might be some other things in there too, but that's always been like the risk-free form of investment. So you put your money in treasury bonds, you have no risk of default or those bonds not being paid in full. At some point, and there'll be a different point for different investors. Different investors will look at it and say, well, they now see a potential default in the future, or what would more likely be the case for the federal government, they would probably look to create money. And so we'd have inflation. But either way, whether you're fearing default or whether you're fearing a lot of inflation that's going to cheapen the money that you get paid back, you're going to ask for a higher interest rate. So what we would see in all likelihood is that the first sign of it would be you start to see the interest rates that have to get paid on treasury bonds start to rise, because that'd be the sign that we are getting close to the end of our line of credit, the amount of money that people are willing to lend to us. And then the problem with that happens is that the amount of interest that we're paying on the debt then starts increasing dramatically. And we've seen some of that just in the last few years with inflation and higher interest rates. The amount that the federal government has had to be paying out in interest total has gone up pretty dramatically. And when you've got $38 trillion of national debt out there, if the interest rates that we have to pay on that start going up, we can't pay off that debt. There's no option to pay that off. All we can do is pay more and more interest on the debt, and that means then that the rising interest payments would be squeezing other things out of the national budget.
So in our budget entitlements, from what your article says, it's an amazing amount of money. You know, if our entitlements are what, 4 trillion of the 6.8 trillion total spending, that's an amazing amount of money. And that is projected to rise, correct?
Correct, yeah. So entitlements are a large part of the budget now, well more than half, approaching about two-thirds or so of the total spending. And then especially because of Medicare and Social Security and the strong the strong dependence of that expenditures on demographics, as we know that more people are approaching retirement, they soon will start drawing Social Security, they'll soon be going on Medicare. As entitlement programs, as more people reach entitlement age and start enrolling in Medicare, that spending goes up automatically, unless the formulas are changed. So we know that in the absence of dramatic changes to the spending formulas, that those entitlement spending, so and particularly Social Security and Medicare, are going to be going up a lot in the years to in the next couple of decades, because that's just there in the age profile of our population, and so that is coming, and we know that that's going to be there.
Well, can we head it off? I mean, there's this. I read an article that in November, the first people that might see getting removed from the SNAP program are going to be able-bodied single men, really, or who are able to work without dependents. I guess single-bodied or able-bodied people, whether it's women and men, I don't know. But is that one way we can start doing, looking at who's taking the benefits and making it more stringent?
Yeah, we could. We could change the formulas, and one that's pretty likely is, and we have been to some extent, like raising the retirement age, especially for full retirement, and then also for the partial or reduced retirement benefits that people can get from Social Security at 62. Medicare is a little harder because once people stop working, then they don't have their health insurance from their job anymore, and so they're going to need to have Medicare. Mm-hmm. So it's a little harder to do stuff to raise the age for fully collecting for collecting Medicare, because once people are no longer working, then at 65 they become eligible for Medicare. So even if we reduce the amount of Social Security we're paying out to them, they're still going to be on Medicare. So there are things we can do. It's probably a little easier to do some things with Social Security. You could also possibly means test Social Security. At one level, there is no reason that some multimillionaire needs to collect a few thousand dollars in Social Security benefits every month. At some level, they've paid in taxes, so you can think of it in that regard that they're entitled to get some of that money back. But again, one of the things we could possibly do to adjust those formulas and in ways that don't really hurt the Americans that are relying heavily on Social Security for their retirements is again, we could do something in terms of means testing Social Security, and something about reducing the payments that go to the wealthier or wealthiest Americans.
I know people won't really care for that. If you're paying for years, literally dozens of years, and then you get the rug pulled, I just, whether you can afford it or not, to me, it's just not right. Is there a way to do it? Maybe having younger people have different strategies. So maybe they put it in, I don't know, IRAs for gold or something else that they can kind of wean themselves off the Social Security track and actually probably make more money, no?
And that's right, because there's still always a hope for trying to do something about Social Security. And the thing that's encouraging about that is, as it stands now, the rate of return that people get on Social Security, it's complicated going and calculate it, but it could be something on the order of like 1%, a 1% return on the money you're putting away. And that would be adjusted for inflation. But then if you look at it like stocks, historically, the stock market has returned about 7% adjusted for inflation annually. So 1% return on your investment is terrible. Mm-hmm. It is not good. So one thing is that even like partial privatization of Social Security or some kind of alternative to it would allow people to accumulate a lot more money than they are with Social Security. I mean, Social Security is just not a very good investment. It's a terrible investment. And especially when you look at like young families in their 20s and they're paying all that Social Security out of it, if they were putting money in an IRA at 25, then by the time they're 65, that amount of money is probably going to have increased. It's by quite possibly by a factor of 16, and because you're putting that money in, and that's the key to retirement saving. Is if you can start saving in your 20s, you get that compound interest going in your favor, and by the time you're ready to retire, that $1,000 you put in there is going to be worth $10,000, $15,000, or so. And that's even like controlling for inflation. So that's the great key. And Social Security just hits Americans so hard because we pay all these taxes for it that the benefits aren't actually guaranteed. It could be slashed. And even according to our current benefit formula, the rate of return is just not good. And so, I mean, I think that's the greatest hope going forward is Social Security. You could still have people as late as like maybe age 50 or 55 would be interested, might be interested in shifting some of their money out of Social Security into some new form of government, a retirement program, and try to take advantage of those higher rates of return because they could do so much better otherwise.
And from a tax standpoint, and I know we're going to take another break, but I just want to start the conversation. Is there anything that you think could be done from a tax standpoint? You know, you save and you still get dinged in interest, you know, whatever money you make, you're going to have to pay taxes on it. If they would just leave people alone and actually encourage them to save without having things taken away from them when they're doing the right thing, do you think that's another strategy that could make a difference in terms of how people behave economically?
Well, there's two things I'll say here. One is by not taxing Social Security benefits, you do sort of help those benefits go a little bit farther. The people can avoid some taxation on them. Many times, by the time people retire, they're even with Social Security and whatever pension they have, they're not making a high level of income every year. So the tax may not be that much that you pay on Social Security when you're drawing it out. But yeah, if we exempt that from if we exempt Social Security payouts from taxes, it helps to go a little bit farther, and maybe it could help a little bit. That's sort of like stretching it a little bit. It's sort of like, I would sort of think of that as like a hamburger helper type of approach. You could do it. It's not a great one. The other thing, and like I'm not in favor of this, is that the level of the payroll taxes could be increased if needed to cover that. Because when you look at it, Social Security historically, recently has been averaging about three people working to support them, pay into the system for every one retiree.
Wow.
And at some point when we get to like 2050, that's going to be down to two people working and paying into the system for one retiree. And we have this pay-as-you-go system. Social Security has a trust fund, but it's not really a real trust fund. It's like maybe some of your listeners, if they're fortunate enough to have been gifted a trust fund from their parents, it's not a real trust fund. But, you know, it has been able to pay out the benefits being paid with the taxes at about a three workers to one retiree level, and that's with about 12% payroll tax on going into Social Security. So even if we get to two workers supporting one retiree, if the benefits remain similar, if we raise the payroll tax to 18% as opposed to 12%. I mean, the numbers would suggest that should largely help keep Social Security from going bankrupt or making sure that we have extra money there. I'm not saying that that's a good solution, and that just makes Social Security even worse for the people working it. The people who would be working and paying it or paying even higher taxes, probably not going to get very much in the way of return on their money. But there are things we could do on the tax side that could help sustain the program.
On that note, let's take our second break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Daniel Sutter. And Dr. Sutter, how can people read what you write? And are you still, do you still have your podcast?
Well, I write and my columns get posted at yellowhammer.com, and I also write occasionally a column on Alabama economic issues at 1819 News. So those are a couple of websites here, news sites here in Alabama.
I want to revisit what we were talking about, because to me there needs to be a sea change. Instead of us piling money into the government and hoping for the best, it's extraordinarily not well managed, right? What about changing the dynamics so people have responsibility for themselves? And wouldn't that still help the economy? If I had more money in my pocket, I'd save it, but I'd also spend something. Wouldn't that also help the economy from a ground-up approach?
I think that's definitely true. I think, ultimately we want to, I personally would like to see Americans be able to have more of their money to spend for themselves. We work hard for our money. We should get to spend that. And, I think the one way to really look at, a lot of economists look to focus not as what we're paying in taxes, but what the level of spending is, because those are the resources that the federal government is directing around. They're getting control of those resources. And that's running around $7 trillion a year. And, we know that with the current government shutdown, the part of that, the big sticking point for the Democrats is they want a lot of the spending that was recently cut in the one big beautiful bill restored, especially like the Obamacare subsidies and then more money for Medicaid. So if anything, the Democrats want to spend more money, perhaps lots more money, but, you know, letting Americans have more of what they earn, I think, would be ultimately a great way to empower all of us to have more control over what we want to do with our lives. And a part of that is also because government spends our money very ineffectively. You know, and so there are very important things that the government spends money on, but they waste a lot of our money in doing that. They spend a lot more than they sort of need to, and we don't get a very good return on our investment.
Well, you know, our last conversation was about the Department of Government Efficiency. And overall, now that it's kind of not so in the forefront, do you think did it accomplish anything? Was it a good thing, or did it just out the fact that our money is just going down a waste, you know, down the toilet most of the time?
I think it did some really great work, and it still is doing some work because, you know, they identified a lot of spending. We had one rescission bill that came through that clawed back or cut about $10 billion in funding. They identified a lot more money that could be cut with another rescission bill. So we know some things that could be cut. It's just a question of whether Congress wants to step up and do something about that. And then it's also, you know, some of the things that they identified, it's going to be a lot harder for Congress to continue to fund that. So, you know, at this point, we're talking about clawing back or rescinding this money that had been previously spent or appropriated. One thing I think we'll see with DOGE going forward is that some of the spending that they identified, I don't think Congress was going to continue to appropriate money for that. So, maybe for like fiscal year 2025, since that money was already been appropriate, we might not get that back. But some of that stuff's just not going to be in the budget going forward. And so I think we'll have to see how much of it. But you know, I had identified closer to like $150 billion in cuts. And so, you know, we'll see. They might end up having more impact than it seems right now. And, you know, the Trump administration I think they are now working on some plans to reduce federal spending or federal employment pretty significantly. But they were stopped by a court injunction for a number of months from even planning this, much less going ahead and implementing it. So a lot of their efforts to try to reduce reduce employment in like the Department of Education and some of the other agencies that were targeting it haven't gone forward yet. And they were, like I said, they were being prevented from even planning that for a while. We'll have to see, because I think, you know, many in the Trump administration seem pretty serious about trying to cut back some of this, some of these positions. And it looks like by the end of this year, we might have as much as like perhaps a 10% reduction in the federal workforce based on the people who have taken the buyouts that were being offered and some of the positions that have been cut so far, and then like, you know, positions that aren't being filled.
Would it be possible with all this savings, could it ever be shifted into the Social Security Trust Fund to prop it up so that we don't have to have anybody taxed to the nines to keep it afloat? Is that reasonable?
I'm sorry, could you say that again? The last part.
With all of the savings that DOGE came up with, could that savings be shifted to something like Social Security, to the trust fund, so that it could be propped up without pain?
Well, that's definitely true, because you're right. And that's why we really need to be cutting spending as much as we can. Over the last few years, Social Security has been paying out more in benefits than it's been collecting in payroll taxes. What it's been doing is they've been paying down the trust fund, in the early decades of Social Security, they were collecting more taxes every year than they were paying out in benefits. And so that was accumulating in, quote, the trust fund. Mm-hmm. Now, they weren't doing much in terms of investing that to generate more revenue going forward. But it was like a savings account. And so they were saving that up. And that's now being spent. And that trust fund, the accumulated balance of taxes, is going to run out by 2023, seems to be about where the prediction is right now. And when that happens, we won't have enough money coming into Social Security from the taxes to pay the benefits. And it's unclear what's going to happen then. My guess is that Congress will have to appropriate extra money to pay the extra benefits that aren't being covered out of the payroll tax. So, yeah, beginning in 2023, Congress is probably going to have to start finding some money to help fund Social Security benefits every year. So, yeah, we would better, every $1 billion we can cut in spending now is just going to make that a little bit easier.
But who's got the will to do it? Because it seems to be a political talking point. Every year it's the same thing. You know, it's people want to see Social Security cut, and you should vote for us because we want to see it expand. There's a lot of talk, but there doesn't seem to be anybody doing anything to stop this inevitability that you just described. It's 2033, correct?
Correct, yeah. So we do have this coming with 2023 or 2033. And some people are saying, because it's unclear, but under current law, for the appropriated funds, if Congress has an appropriated funds, then they can't be spent. And so it's possible that Social Security benefits would be cut by about 20% in 2023. I think I believe Congress could certainly appropriate money to cover that. But, you know, we've got, we're just not in a very good situation. We really need to be looking to try to find more money to cut now. And this is coming, and some of everybody sees it coming, but I think this is one situation where people on both sides sort of recognize that a train wreck is coming, but you've got fiscal conservatives, people who want to see a much smaller government, and then you've got people who want to see a much bigger government than we currently have. And if the fiscal conservatives agree, okay, we can hike taxes significantly, then they're never going to get government down to the size that they like. And if the people who like to see government grow much more, if they say, okay, we agree to spending cuts to address the deficit, mm-hmm. then they know they're never spending will be cut from what it is, and they would like to probably see it be $3-5 trillion more than it currently is. So you've got a situation. Whichever side blinks first or agrees to either raise taxes or cut spending knows that they will never get their preferred level of federal government spending. So at this point, we've got two trains rushing at each other, and the engineers are driving those trains want to flip the switch to take their train off the track, because then they know that they will never get their spending to the level they want it.
It seems like it's all about winning, not about really what's best for the country, from what you just described. How can it possibly be better to have a bigger government when we're already bankrupt? I mean, who thinks that way, and why would they?
So why do some people think that the government should be spending a lot more money? Well,
yeah, we don't have it.
Well, let's see. You know, they would look to see that some folks, you know, certainly some folks have, some Americans deserve to have higher level of earnings. So, I mean, if you look at some of the proposals, where you see people talk about the minimum wage or a living wage, and you know, how they might want to get to it. And there are some folks who are saying that should be like $30 an hour or $40 an hour. And, you know, if you think of $30 an hour with a living wage, that works out to about $60,000 a year if you're working full time. Mm-hmm. Well, the only way you're going to get to that And since many workers are not possibly going to be able to be productive enough that if employers would be willing to pay them that much, this government would have to step in and provide a lot of subsidies to businesses to hire people. So if a business would pay somebody $20,000, and then the government would give them $40,000, and they could get paid that $30 an hour wage. But they would have to have a lot of government spending come with it. And another thing we'd be looking at, like, you know, college. I mean, people think that the college should be free, and that, you know, the existing student loans, which are somewhere on the order of $1.7 trillion, should be wiped out. And if you're going to make college free and keep the tuition that in effect, let the colleges keep collecting the amount that they're collecting now in tuition or through loans, the government's going to have to step in again and spend a lot of money there. So that there are some things, and, you know, and Medicaid doesn't provide very good coverage. So you think of, like, the proposals for Medicare for All, you know, suggesting that Americans who are currently enrolled in Medicaid, which has really pretty bad benefits in many states. It differs from state to state. States run those programs. But many Medicaid enrollees don't get very good coverage. So again, that would be another area where you could look at it and be saying, we could spend a lot more money there.
You know, I'm going to take another on our last break, because the first thing that comes to my mind is everything the government has put money into has become more expensive. So let's take our last break, because I want to get your take on that. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Sutter. And before the break, it just struck me that, you know, everything that the government has come into, whether it's higher education, it didn't cost me, my parents, all that much money to send me to college back in the day. And now it's like medical school. I mean, how are you spending $60,000 a year in tuition for nothing? And the government is subsidizing it. There's student loans. These guys have huge endowments, but they're still using the government to kind of subsidize them. I'm talking about the universities. So as the government spends money, it's just people just spend more, right? I mean, at some point, the government shouldn't be in things, don't you think?
Well, yeah, it's certainly the issue with higher education in college shows a fundamental issue, you know, fundamental fallacy, and that is that the cost of things aren't really set or fixed. When you talk about the cost of college or the cost of medical care, there are lots of different dimensions of things that could happen here. And, you know, when you talk about college, we say, well, you know, how should your dorm room be appointed? You know, should you have like a flat, 62-inch flat screen TV in your dorm room? Should you have a 4-star chef preparing meals in the cafeteria? Should we have people come in? Because there's actually some research showing you know, have somebody come in the middle of classes. We'll take a little break and do some calisthenics, because it helps give some blood flow. So we have to hire a bunch of people to come in and do lead classes in calisthenics with mid-class breaks. There are almost an unlimited number of things that you could spend money on with regard to college. You could hire a private tutor for each student. There are all kinds of things you can do. So there's no cost of college independent of all of these decisions you make. There's no cost of health care independent of all of the decisions you have to make for health care. I mean, one thing that comes up with Medicaid is, do you pay for people's medical transportation? If somebody has to go and get treatments and they can't drive themselves to or from that treatment because, you know, after they get their treatment, they're not able to drive, well, do you pay for a medical taxi to get people to their treatments? There are dozens, maybe hundreds of different questions you have to ask here. And so we always think, well, let's just have the government cover the cost. And one problem with that is that the cost isn't actually fixed. And then we see all these decisions. And that's what we've seen with higher education since 1965 in the Higher Education Act.
The government sort of said, written something like a blank check to cover the cost of college. And colleges have kept adding stuff to that cost. Mm-hmm. And our elite colleges now have more administrators than we have undergraduate students. So, I mean, you've gone to really kind of ridiculous levels of spending, way beyond anything that, that you'd have in the classroom. But that's just in part due to this fallacy that the cost isn't actually fixed.
Well, that's superimposed all into the healthcare system too, right? So we have the pharmacy benefit management companies deciding the cost of the drugs, and that's completely inflated with nobody stepping in to do anything about it. And then you have these consortiums of the health insurance company, the pharmacy, and the pharmacy benefit management company, from a healthcare perspective, deciding what I can write as a prescription for my patient. It's never what I want to give the patient, but someone's making money and taking their cut from it. This is where I think the government can actually help. If they would step in and look at these things, because they don't add anything. They're not value added. They just inflate the cost and they don't do anything. So from that standpoint, I think instead of the government just spending money and saying, okay, we'll just spend it, think about it. Ask the people who are actually on the ground, the parents, right, for the education side, doctors, nurses for the healthcare side. Maybe we would get a little bit more realism in the amount of money that we're spending, because it's completely arbitrary. I mean, for example, the GoodRx system, where you can buy drugs for pennies if you pay out of pocket versus using your insurance company. So there's this price, disequilibrium, depending on which side of the healthcare system you enter at. You're either going to save a ton of money or you're going to be spending more than anybody else. And that's something wrong with that.
Well, that's right, because and that's, to one sense, I see that's a problem with the government involved, because there are a lot of ways for people to inflate bill, and you can have it, if you just go to the hospital and you're paying your expenses yourself, there are ways they can inflate the bill for that. If you just go to a lawyer, they can do stuff to inflate the bill. If we're paying for it ourselves, we're at least going to look things over and maybe contest some things. Mm-hmm. But when you have the government paying on behalf of people, the government will pick a bone here and there, but then it's not actually the us who are paying who have the same incentive to scrutinize things. Employers do it a little bit on our behalf if they have employer paid covered health insurance, but still the big thing we don't have all of these decisions coming back to us and our preferences and what we would like to have covered. You see that probably with prescriptions, that mm-hmm. What things the prescription drug benefits will cover, and then what things they won't, and they might not be the actual things that many of us as consumers would like to see covered, and they might be covering other things that don't really care that much. Mm-hmm. We just don't get that feedback where we get everything fine-tuned to exactly what we want to have spend. And so that's a formula for wasting money. We spend $100, but we only get effectively like $80 benefit worth out of it.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, in your article, you talk about block grants, for example, to Medicaid in the States. And you said that's a much better way to control costs, right? Because you can't just have a blank check to spend, and you can't just give it to your cronies or whatever in the state side. But does it give people more responsibility? Because it's a finite amount of money. Either you use it correctly and that's all you're getting. Is that a better way maybe to try to tamp down on this recklessness?
For Medicaid, we should really change the formula. The federal government pays a lot of the money. It's about two-thirds or three-quarters of Medicare spending, but we do it with what are known as matching grants. And if we move to block grants, where you just give a state a fixed amount of money, then you could let states decide what they want to cover. And if a state decides they want to cover
some non-citizens, and it gets into some finer definitions here. They might be with some of these parolees as opposed to illegal immigrants. But if California wants to cover something like that, then they would be covering that entirely out of their own pocket. And so if the lawmakers in California want to find the money to appropriate an extra $10 billion or $20 billion to pay for that, it's their taxes. I don't live there. I don't plan to live there. If they want to do that, that's one thing. But as it stands now, they're getting a big portion of that money from the federal government with these matching grants. So that would be a much more fiscally responsible way to do stuff. We saw big savings in the 1990s with welfare and tax assistance programs when we moved out.
That's fair. So you're saying at this point that the other states are literally through their taxes are subsidizing what states like California want to do with their local citizens?
Exactly.
That's not right.
And it's worse than that. You get into these scams called Medicaid provider taxes. And so states end up getting most of their Medicaid actually paid for on the margin by the federal government.
You know, I was curious, what is that exactly? How does that work?
Well, a Medicaid provider tax?
Yeah.
The brief part of it, the sort of the non-detailed part of it is that most states are supposed to pay about 50% of 50 cents on the dollar of all their medical expenditures. The federal government will pay the rest, will pay the other 50 cents. But then you can do these things where you tax a hospital, and then they pay this tax, and you call that the state's Medicaid provider, the Medicaid contribution. But then the hospital just increases the bill that they give to Medicaid, so they get the tax right back.
Oh wow!
And so it ends up making it something. You know, in many cases, something like the federal government's paying like 90%, even if they're supposed to only be paying 50%. It's a scam, and the details get very complicated. But that's the gist of it. It's a way to, on paper, cover that 50% or whatever the state is supposed to be paying for Medicaid.
So it comes right back around. Of course, the taxpayer holding the bag,
exactly.
And then the individual who needs the services, not having the hospital open if it's rural or something, somebody's not benefiting that needs to get what they want, you know, what they need from a healthcare perspective. And that goes to the physician and the nursing staff, et cetera. I mean, the system is not, it's on quicksand from what you just spent the hour describing. And unless somebody has the gall, you know, the gumption to say, no, it stops, you know, we have to really be fiscally sound. We have to do the right thing for the right reason. It's time for people to stop wanting to get elected and do the right thing for their constituents, right?
I think so. And, you know, I don't underestimate the value of some of these cuts. Like the One Big Beautiful Bill actually cut out the funding for, or I guess it was the rescission bill that cut the funding for public television or the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Mm-hmm.
That's a trivial amount of money, in one sense, $1 billion. But it's an amount that can be so easily covered out of other sources. I think it's very symbolic, because if we can't cut that spending, we can't address these other issues. Because, you know, there's ways that these public television stations can make up that with extra donations or gifts from foundations or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They'll never really miss it. But if you couldn't eliminate that, you know, something that small, we were never going to be able to address bigger spending issues. So we've actually done some stuff. We've cut the subsidies for NPR and PBS. Cut a lot, most of the USAID foreign aid budget. You know, those are modest in themselves, but they open up new possibilities. And DOGE got us talking about significant potential budget cuts. It's changing the whole conversation. It's changing the whole dialogue.
I think that's a great place to end our conversation, because it is hopeful that if we start making some, you know, real important decisions, it's going to be able to help the bigger, the broader picture, and especially for people who are seniors and the people who need our help, not just people who don't, but people who actually do need these programs to survive. So, Dr. Sutter, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. Time goes way too quickly, but I want to thank you again for your time.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to come on and do your show.
Thank you. I can't wait to have you back. Thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.